Brian Harrison and Melissa Michelson. Touche with Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. And live music in Studio 435 with J.C. Brooks. And now, here's your host, a man who wonders if he'd be better off going open-toe this summer, Justin Kaufman.
Or like a sandal that's almost like a shoe that's like a contraption. It kind of looks, it's just a bunch of crisscross leather. Right, one of those, like I look like an ancient Greek track star. What about that? Who wears that? I feel like I'm interested in this footwear. You know what I mean? I've always been sort of a closed toe guy. But maybe this is my summer. Maybe I go open toe. Change it up. Welcome to The Download, everybody. Justin Kaufman here with you till 11 o'clock tonight on 720 WGN. We got a great show lined up tonight. Kick off this wonderful week. Some severe weather heading through some of the area tonight, but so far, so good in the Chicago area, especially here on Michigan Avenue. A ton of people out and about as temperatures level off and are going to hit up to 80, 90 degrees. I hear Tom Skilling talking about 90 degrees this week. All right. Touche coming up with Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy after the 7:30 news. That's good. That's going to be a good one. Lots to talk about. I don't even know where to respond. We'll just save it for the segment. Ro was talking about it for the last hour, and it's such an. I mean, the White House says no, nothing was leaked, no classified information was talked about in the meeting with the Russians. But the Washington Post has several anonymous sources that say there was classified information discussed. We'll talk about it coming up on Touche after 7:30. Also tonight, the authors of Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Brian Harrison, Melissa Michelson will be here tonight. This is really, really fascinating academic work. And I know that that's somewhat of an oxymoron. But, I mean, the idea that we are such a divided country, and most of the time public polls and polling on certain issues do not change. If you look at the death penalty, you look at abortion, you look at other big-ticket items that we are divided 50-50, most of the time, decade after decade after decade, it does not swing. Doesn't matter what's being talked about, it does not swing. The one anomaly, gay marriage. In the 70s, I think it was, or actually the 80s, 1988 maybe, it was 11% of the country polled said they favored gay marriage. As of 2016, it was 60-something percent. The authors look at why that is, what the change was, and if that can be sort of a blueprint to how we look at some of the big ticket items that are dividing us today. That's coming up 8 o'clock. I'm looking forward to that. 9 o'clock, we'll talk about the big ticket item that divided us in the past, the Nancy Kerrigan, Tanya Harding debacle of 1994, the, of course, ice skating drama set to stage now in the new play T. The world premiere at the American Theater Company coming up this week. We'll talk with the director. Also, ghost restaurants, takeout windows only. Restaurants getting rid of the brick and mortar and going for takeout. They realize that's the future. With delivery services abound, why not just give the people what they want? We'll talk about that. And live music tonight in Studio 435 with J.C. Brooks. That's a show. All right, we'll take a break. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr, Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, here it is. It's The Download, 720 WGN. Coming up, Touche, but first, the carryout. Here are today's top stories. Whoopsies! President Trump allegedly spoke of classified information in his recent conversation with the Russians, which wouldn't be a big deal except for the fact that Trump and Republicans made it a big deal throughout the campaign, i.e. Hillary Clinton and the emails. Hey, listen, I don't have any skin in the game, really. I truly do not. This is not the mainstream media whining about why Hillary wasn't elected, but I am saying the Republicans did successfully run on the idea that Clinton broke the law by possibly giving up classified information, which did not happen, but could have because she was using her own server. And the FBI didn't prosecute her because it was proven to be accidental ignorance, meaning they couldn't prove intent that she was purposely giving classified info via email. Okay, we up to speed? Good? Okay, so if it's true and the White House says it is not, if you hear McMaster, it is not, which makes it worse if it is, But if true, Trump just willingly gave up classified information to would-be adversaries. So tell me, Republican congressman who railed and railed and railed and railed against Clinton for the past 2 years, how outraged are we supposed to be? Because that hunt was nonpartisan, right? It was strictly about classified info, right? So 5 years ago, we didn't really care because you didn't care. But now you've told us that possibly revealing classified info is the worst crime known to humanity ever. So what do we do with it? Just tell me. Explain how this is different. Is it different because Clinton was accidental and Trump was on purpose? Is that the difference? Is it different because it was a person, in person, instead of digital? I'm not judging. I'm asking. Again, I'm not a whiny Hillary supporter here. I'm an American taxpayer who has bought into the idea that our elected and appointed officials should be cautious with classified information. Otherwise, there are consequences, right? That's what you told us. Some even said that if Clinton won, you'd impeach her for the crimes, saying her carelessness was treason. Is that still the case? Or did we move on from that? There's nothing Americans hate more than a lack of consistency. Just look at baseball. Strike zones change at all, and people throw chairs through windows. So which is it? Is it treason, or is it an accident? And put the rest to bed. That was my emotional plea. I don't know if you felt the emotion there. All right, let's get local. Tronc, the company that owns the Tribune, is going after the Chicago Sun-Times. It wants to put an offer in to buy the paper. It's too early to tell if this means Chicago's going to be a one-newspaper town, but one thing's for certain, Tronc is a terrible name. Tronc is like the sound a donkey makes when it's kicked in the nether regions. Tronc! So here we are, the long-rumored dystopian future where there was only one newspaper in Chicago, not to mention the soap opera drama that would be if Michael Farrow was owning both papers. My big question, though, is do they still do two sets of horoscopes? And if they're different, then doesn't that just destroy astrology as we know it? I mean, they're the same company with two different interpretations? Phew, mind blown. The water department... My computer just got taken over by ransomware. Oh, great. Now what? They want 50 million Bitcoin or I won't be able to read the rest of the carryout here. Luckily, I have it on me. 50 million Bitcoin is just about 38 cents. There we go. We good? Oh, great. They took my Kenny Loggins music. Had a whole folder in there. Oh, we're good. The water department head and a middle manager out after a racist email exchange was discovered. Come on. It's 2017. Text that joke. You deserve the consequences if you're using the city email to forward an email with the subject forward, 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 check this out. Also, the Sun-Times is reporting that this was discovered because they were investigating whether or not the middle manager was using his city email to sell guns. Double whammy. Hey, I know I like to buy my guns from a guy who has a water department email. I mean, I understand it makes me feel more secure, but seriously? I mean, if the seller's using Yahoo or AOL, I just can't trust him. But if it's a city email, I'm in. In weather? Come on, best day ever, right? You can admit it. Perfect. Maybe a little windy, rain on the way. I love Chicago because it's the first truly nice day, and it's just a parade of spandex and spaghetti straps like it's been hot for 3 weeks, and these are the only clothes left before laundry day. And then there's the one lady who just doesn't buy it, who's still wearing the winter fleece. She's clutching. In sports, the Cubs went into St. Louis this weekend looking to send a message and instead received one, and that is don't expect a cakewalk. The Cards took 2 of 3 from the Cubs, who are starting to show some depth issues with myriad injuries. We got to see minor league phenom Ian Happ, who did pretty good, 3 hits in 2 games he played. But no Chris Bryant, Jason Hayward, Ben Zobrist a little bit. Cubs get a night off tonight, which is probably good. They're currently 18-19, 3.5 back to the Cardinals. The Brewers and Reds have better records. Ugh. And to make matters worse, Cub fans, the White Sox won 2 of 3 in dramatic fashion. They're also a game under 500. Who would have thought in mid-May they would have identical records? The White Sox were 2 innings away from being swept by the Padres in Chicago, so let's not get too excited about the White Sox. But they needed it. They got it. Now they're out, head out west to Anaheim tonight to play the Angels. This will be a big test on the road against a team that's just as mediocre. Tonight, Game 7 between the Celtics and the Wizards in the NBA playoffs. Could you imagine? This could have been us if Rondo... All right. Who am I kidding? Even more depressing, the Predators and the Ducks have split the first two games of their Western Conference final, the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Predators' defense finally came down to earth last night. They actually looked like the Predators, right? Not the world beaters we saw in the first round. And finally tonight, someone stole a bunch of pens from a car parked by the museum campus. The pens belonged to a collector and were valued at $40,000. What? That's a lot of pens. That had to be an inside job, right? Because I can't imagine the common car thief having the knowledge on where to sell that stuff. Hey, man, you need drugs? How about a gun? Or how about an 18th century Waterman gentleman fountain pen complete with original converter, outer sleeve, display box, and papers? No? Well, how about some socks? I got tube socks, too. That's a carryout from May 15, 2017. Hey, it's going to be 90 degrees this week. That's too hot to cook, so carry out. We'll even throw in a few wet naps for you, just to beat the heat. Coming up, we'll talk about this Washington Post report. Trump, touche. What's this mean? Oh my lord. Classified information. Here we go again. It's the Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
You know, Justin, you know me. I don't like to toot my own horn, yeah. Even though I was part of that Lissagore award-winning team on the UIC Trump, you know, canceling his speech team. So, I don't like to do that. But, man, was my pasta sauce this weekend fantastic. I cooked for Mother's Day, so I made meatballs and sauce and sausage.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Did you bring some in?
You know what? I will, actually.
Yeah.
I'll bring it in tomorrow.
Bring it in,
Because
yes.
We've got loads of extra.
Taste test.
Yeah. How was your Mother's Day?
It was great, man. We got the flowers up. The rabbits are in check. Things are looking up, man.
How are you keeping the bonnets in check?
Right now, it's a mixture, a couple of we planted a lot of stuff they don't like and a couple of sprays.
Okay.
That's where we're going to see
All
if
right.
it works.
All
but
right.
It looks good so far.
Sounds good.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay. I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. Download 720 WGN. In this corner, Dave Lundy. In the other corner, Chris Roebling. It's on.
Yeah.
Who do we believe? Do we believe the White House or do we believe the Washington Post? Why don't we start with Dave Lundy?
Well, you know, this White House has been so circumspect with the truth, and they have not lied to us yet.
There are people just getting in their car. They don't know what we're talking about. Come on.
I think they do know what we're talking about.
Well, let's just be sure.
All right, so set it up. Set it up, Chris Roebling.
Go for it, Chris.
Set it up.
Well, at about 4:30,
I want to hear your interpretation.
About 4:30 this afternoon, the Washington Post moved a story that said intelligence community sources had confirmed to the current and former government officials of a high rank had confirmed this afternoon to the Washington Post that in his meeting with Sergei Lavrov and the Russian ambassador the very day after he fired James Comey, President Trump revealed sensitive intelligence, classified intelligence information.
Classified, yeah.
Classified intelligence information.
Actually,
from a
super high clearance classified, code word clearance.
Code classified. Word clearance classified information from a close partner in the fight against ISIS about an ISIS activity, either planned or anticipated, something like this. And the officials on whom the Post said it was relying then said that doing so without consulting with the originating source of the intelligence, the overseas intelligence service,
would be a violation.
Would break a unwritten partnership agreement with that organization and could complicate our intelligence gathering with respect to ISIS in the future.
Now, why are people up in arms about this, Dave Lundy?
Well, first of all, the White House is denying it, but it has been reported and re-reported and re-reported, not just by the Post, but by the New York Times, by CNN, by BuzzFeed, by probably half a dozen other media organizations at this point. And I'll just read. So this just happens from BuzzFeed, but you can read the same thing in the New York Times or any place else. Two U.S. officials who were briefed on Trump's disclosures last week confirmed to BuzzFeed the veracity of the Washington Post report, with one noting that it's far worse than has already been reported. and it's about the extent of classified information. So the question is, I heard McMaster, the National Security Advisor, deny this and claim it was false, but he said the story as reported is false. It's a classic Washington dodge for saying, well, what you reported is wrong because you have three words wrong,
but
it's not saying
happen,
the substance
right?
is actually wrong. And what is concerning is that, first of all, let's not forget about this meeting. This was the meeting after the day after he fired Comey,
yep.
in which you had Lavrov and Kislyak, the Russian ambassador who's the KGB spy the FSB spy master in Washington, in the Oval Office with no U.S. media presence. The only people present was a TASS photographer. TASS, the
not
Russian
for the
news
meeting.
Agency.
Come on,
who
not
tweeted
for the
out,
meeting?
Fine. The photographer was not present for the meeting. He was in the Oval Office. There was no other.
But this
was
the,
no media.
This
there.
Was the
no
question
US
about
there.
Optics and having a meeting the day
it was
after
absurd.
James Comey.
Well,
was
he had them in, and he, I think it was dumb too. He had them in, and he had instead of bringing in a pool reporter for the U.S. and a pool photographer for the U.S., he just had the Soviet state media.
So okay, so 219 makes a great point, and this is the point that 219. Is going to be 219 says.
Well, do I get
who
to answer
the post sources? This is I'm helping you. I'm setting
you
up.
Okay, good.
Who were the post sources? Because nobody from the Post was in that room. And it begs the question,
right.
as the people that were in the room said this did not happen, but the Washington Post says it did.
Thank you, 219, and I just want to say the point is we don't know. The Washington Post says it was a current and a former, current and former high government official. So sounds like two, sounds like one current, one former. Probably the one current would be the one who, according to David's recitation from BuzzFeed, was briefed on something afterwards. And then the former could be any one of a zillion people. We have three people on the record, officials of the government. Dina Powell, who is the Deputy National Security Advisor, mm-hmm. General H.R. McMaster, who is the National Security Advisor, yep. and Rex Tillerson, all of whom were in the meeting.
Right.
And Dina Powell says, quote, the story is false. David is splitting hairs.
I'm not splitting hairs.
David is
none
splitting
of them would stand and take questions from the media
I'm sorry.
So that you can inquire about
this. You don't
this.
Go into media questions with a false report about classified material. I want to say this. This is evidence, in my opinion, and I don't like Trump, and I'm upset with Trump, and I think I'm doing a big Ann Coulter on Trump. What the heck are we really getting with Trump? Okay, but he is our president, and this is an unnamed, these are unnamed sources versus officials of the government.
Back to my first question. Where do you go? Do you go, is it the Washington Post or the White House that we believe?
So the problem is, and this is where the fact that the White House has been lying again and again, literally from day one with Sean Spicer's briefing about crowd size, and ever since then, this is what happens. You destroy their credibility. So most people now are, in fact, Bob Corker, the senator chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, said the White House is spiraling down. They've got to get control of this. He believed it right away because it didn't surprise him in the slightest that this White House is so sloppy and the president is so sloppy that he would do precisely
that. That's a great point.
I read it and I thought, oh my God. And I posted it right away. I said, this is terrible if this is what happened. I don't now with the fact that they have responded so quickly and so definitively, I don't think it happened in the way that it is being reported by media, which is devoted 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to getting rid of Trump. OK, just like David.
No.
I mean, David and these guys are not they're not honest brokers and they're not actually looking at stuff. Sometimes I like Trump. Sometimes I think Trump's an idiot. I think you can rely on me.
But
listeners,
you
can
the Washington
rely
Post.
On me.
Yeah, you can rely on Roebling.
Yep.
The Washington Post, though, I mean,
WaPo is owned
giving,
by Jeff Bezos and it despises Trump.
So you believe that this
and what
is
about
a,
the Times? And what about
CNN?
Well,
the Times obviously despises
about,
Trump. The entire Chris, mainstream media is a representation of the establishment.
The substance
Trump
of
was
the
sent
story
there.
Has been.
You don't know
re-
the substance
no,
of the story.
It has been re-reported and confirmed
you do not
by
know.
Numerous right. organizations.
You don't know one person who
you can't handle the
that.
Truth.
You don't know one person right. who has stood up for that story.
Ding! And the bell goes off. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy getting at it tonight.
Well, I mean, Lundy's
argue.
Just talking up his
right,
sleeve and
on.
Threw his hat at the same time. It's an anatomical impossibility.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. More Touche. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling here on The Download.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche, Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy. Let me get 219 in. So sick of people trashing credible news outlets who employ professionals and ethical standards. More than I can say for the administration.
See, that says, 219 I like.
The fact of the matter is that the story is consistent with the history of the man before and after the presidency. So what reasonable person will not believe this? Uh-huh. And 630 says, let's take a minute to just ponder this. What kind of story would this be to have been totally made up with all these crazy details? 100% believe the Post story, and if it turns out to not be true, then it's a whole other sad story about the credibility level of this administration. So, Dave Lundy, what is, if it's true and you believe it to be true, what does it, what's the next step? What does this mean?
So, I believe that it to be largely true, and what I mean by that is it is entirely possible
the story
that
could be wrong, right?
Reporters get, you know, can get small details wrong, but the general substance of
the interpretation could be 75% of the 100%,
exactly.
Right, exactly.
So, but I believe the general substance of it, which is that Donald Trump's got a big mouth, which big surprise, can't be trusted with classified information. And what is so striking about this is I seem to remember a presidential campaign last year where every Republican from Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and Bob Corker and every other Republican on the planet said, oh my God, how could you elect this person president if they can't be trusted with classified information? And the things that were released in her emails about her emails are so insignificant compared to this.
You don't know that
this kind of thing.
You have no clue what you're talking about.
Question for you. Question based off the 630.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Before the idea that the administration has this president has shown before and after the campaign that he does play loose and fast and loose with classified information and truth. I mean, is there anything to be said that this is sort of in the, I guess, the type that is President Trump?
Well, I agree with David that he's a loudmouth and that he's been shown to be a loudmouth for the last, say, 30 years of his career and the 4 months he's
been
president.
Could he have been a loudmouth
and that he's indiscreet? It's not about being a loudmouth.
And he's indiscreet. He says crazy stuff.
Could he be an indiscreet loudmouth in a meeting with a Russian
minister? Does that mean that he would reveal highly classified, sensitive information? I don't really think so. I don't think it would necessarily say that.
You're, of course, wondering whether a guy who demanded a loyalty test from the FBI director upon meeting him 6 days after being sworn in might do something wildly inappropriate. Yeah, come on. This is Donald Trump. People will believe anything about this guy because he pushes the envelope every single day.
Let me give, in fairness, Chris, you believe this story to be untrue. What does it mean if it's proven to be untrue?
He doesn't even believe it to be untrue.
But if proven to be false, what does it mean?
I believe that we've got three very high officials of the government denying the story on the record in their own proper person. Okay. And you put that up against the Washington Post or BuzzFeed or whatever it is, whatever site David is reading.
That was a non-denial denial, Chris.
No,
do you believe the story has any merit or truth?
No.
No.
At this moment, I don't. At this moment, we've got a total denial by the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Deputy National Security. And what we know for sure is that the establishment and the Democrats, of which both represent the media and the media represents both, Democrats and the establishment, they're all three out to get Trump no matter what.
And Chris still believes that Comey was fired because Comey was mean to Hillary.
No, I don't.
Give me a break.
I don't. I think that Comey was fired because he flouted FBI procedures and because Trump was idiotically concerned about the Russian investigation. I believe the Russian investigation has to be accelerated because otherwise David is going to use this as his Benghazi. Whereas we had a Benghazi where terrible things actually happened and four true blue Americans died because Hillary couldn't decide what the Marines were going to wear when they finally got off of the ship and it didn't or off of the airplane and it didn't matter by that point. That was her Benghazi and people really died. David is now going to use
this. We have
this
bipartisan
phony,
agreement here.
Absolutely phony baloney Russian story. As his
phony
Benghazi.
Baloney, because there was no Russian interference in the U.S. election.
No,
none
because,
whatsoever.
No, because there's no collusion. There, you know, you guys, Democrats, if you,
you know,
read
first,
the
first, you
Soviet,
say there were no contacts. You say there were
no
contacts between Trump people
I never said
and
that.
Russians. And
I never
every
said
time,
that.
Every time
you're
a
making
new,
that up.
No.
I have never said there
okay,
were no
you
contacts.
You also said that that there was no interference in the Republican
I
platform
never said
by
that.
The Trump campaign.
Well, that one I did say. I did say that. And
thank
I don't
you.
Think there was any Russian interference in the Trump campaign or in the Republican platform.
Except there's evidence again and again
No, there isn't.
What we do not have yet is proof of collusion.
Here is what you
need. I agree with you. We need to accelerate the investigation.
Okay, good. So we agree on that. But here is here is the key part. This is a war unlike anything we've ever seen before. And it is a war by all dimensions of the establishment in Washington, including the Republican establishment in Washington, which does not like or appreciate Trump at all.
So a war between everybody versus Donald Trump.
I think it is between the establishment and what they consider to be anything that is animating Trump right. and his administration. And at times that includes Paul Ryan, and at times it includes Mitch McConnell.
I understand that. And I agree with you. And the problem is that Donald Trump doesn't help his case.
Yes.
He goes in and he does this where he thinks he's just
We're
being
all in
a,
agreement on that.
Yeah, where he's just being
Trump makes life miserable for Trump and the rest of us. Yes.
So there is an argument to be said that
he's an idiot on
the
this
establishment
stuff.
Is the one leaking to the papers because they don't want to change things. But the problem is that it's info that should be leaked.
Well, and he lied last week.
Now, wait a minute. You're accepting the truth of the matter asserted. I'm saying there are unclean hands back there, so we may or may not be.
It could be false. You're right.
But he lied last week. The Comey thing is so important. The way he handled it and mishandled it by first lying and saying it was about Comey and Clinton, and then saying other things, and then eventually
When did Trump say? It
was only his vice president and 20 different Republican spokespeople saying exactly the same thing.
Just keep that in mind. That's part of the problem. Part of the problem with this guy, unlike people who come up through politics and understand, if I'm going to say something at the town hall meeting on Tuesday, it has to connect with what my press secretary said last Thursday to the local news reporter. That kind of discipline has never been entered upon
the brain of
Trump.
They thought they could get away with it, and when they got the blowback they got, they realized they couldn't, and then Trump
You're losing your own point. Your point is this. You don't get it. Your point is
Trump makes
life miserable by backtracking on his own statements out of the White House.
My point is that Trump makes life miserable by lying his
head
off.
I just love it. Your point is that should be the name of this.
You
segment.
Don't understand your own
out.
Point.
Your point is,
I have to argue his points for him too.
Can I make a editorial?
And you're doing what McMaster just did.
I want to
you falsely assert something and then say no. Oh, that's not right.
What do you think? You guys stick around? You want to stick around and we'll do a little bit after the news?
Can you stay
for a little bit longer, Chris? I know you're already out of things to talk
Chris's
about.
Chris's head's exploding.
Roebling, Lundy, Touche, an extra bonus segment coming up after the 8 o'clock news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Because of the news, we got a bonus segment of Touche with Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling coming up.
Ding, ding, ding.
I couldn't call it. You know, I was looking for I was too close to call, so we're going overtime.
I'm ringside right now, and the fight card suggests that this is a close fight.
Hey, Rob.
Yes.
That shirt you're wearing, weren't you wearing that shirt when I saw you Friday night?
Well, I've got two versions of the same shirt.
Come on, you got to get
for
one.
You're like Bruce Rauner with his plaids.
It was a different shade. Don't worry, I threw the Friday nights. It's in the wash.
Yeah,
don't worry.
Come on, man. Sunday's a laundry day. I'm doing the same thing here.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what you said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go all right?
Overtime.
All right. Segment three.
Ding! Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, as we, we had a whole... Email today. I admit I was late on the emails, but
yeah, where were
we had
you?
Gone back and forth. I mean, we had some other things we want to talk about, and this story just comes in and quote unquote trumps it all. No pun intended. Of course, we're talking about the Washington Post story today that it's possible that President Trump gave classified information to a meeting with the Russians last week.
I think whatever else, this just shows once again. I've been saying for a couple of months that Reince Priebus is not up to the job. And I think that's in part because he's not up to the job. And it's also in part because Trump has not yielded sufficient authority to anybody in that White House to actually ride herd on what's going on. This is a very rattletrap White House, and it is not operating in the best interest of the American people. And when you have stuff like this going on, whatever the heck happened in there. I doubt it's as portrayed by the Post, which is out to get Trump and have him impeached, which I don't get, because then they'll have Pence and Pence knows what he's doing. So, but regardless, what you are talking about here is a White House staff that just day after day after day shows it does not know what it is doing. Although we must give them credit for the fact they're dealing with the right. world's most difficult
do you,
president.
You're just saying that. Do you truly
no,
think
I'm
that,
not just
no,
saying
no, no,
that.
No, but I'm
I
saying,
have been saying
No,
this.
But I'm saying, do you truly believe that the Washington Post is out to get Donald Trump?
Absolutely.
But you just said it's because he's creating an untenable kind of White House.
Trump himself is right. A difficult guy. That doesn't mean that the Post or the Times or the Tribune or the San Francisco Chronicle should be out to destroy the president of the United States. They're out to destroy him because they are part of the establishment and because of the threat that he represents.
Dave Lundy.
Or they're out to do their job and actually investigate things. And the president keeps giving them lots and lots and lots of material to investigate. I mean, saying Trump is a difficult guy is like saying Michael Jordan was pretty good at basketball. I mean, this is a president unlike any other in the history of the Republic. He's a total disaster. He's a train wreck. And you're right. Ryan's Priebus is not up to the job. But nobody is going to be able to corral this guy, because when he gets into the Oval with Lavrov and Kislyak, he's the president. It's up to him. If what the Post and Reuters and New York Times and everybody else has reported is true, if it was anybody other than the president, he violated federal law.
If he violated federal law in this case, and let's say that this becomes true and everyone says this is the law of the land, what does it mean?
Well, it doesn't mean anything because he's the president and he can declassify it.
Exactly.
Because as Richard Nixon, his idol said.
Don't invoke Nixon. That is false.
I'm sorry. When Nixon said, when the president does it, it's not illegal.
Well, that happens to be accurate in this particular case. When Nixon said it, he was referring to matters way beyond this case. Nixon was wrong then. David, of course, is wrong now. But I'm telling you the truth. And the truth is, look, I didn't endorse this guy. I kept telling people to find, Ted Cruz or Rand Paul or some other Republican.
Or Ben Carson, who was your first love.
Ben Carson. What's wrong with Ben Carson? He's doing a great job at HUD. So I'm not for Trump, but he is our president. And if you get rid of him, the liberals who want to get rid of him, they're going to be stuck with Pence.
But for the record, I have neither said that I expect impeachment. I have neither pushed for impeachment. I think impeachment is a liberal fantasy.
Yeah.
And I think that the idea that
closer.
Paul Ryan is going to launch impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump is insane.
Right.
The moment the Republicans finally stand up and even call for an independent investigation, I'll believe maybe they're developing.
I mentioned this earlier in the show that to me, as just an American taxpayer voter, what gets me is the fact that if this is true, we've heard ad nauseum. 4 years, 5 years of Hillary Clinton has destroyed the public trust. She could have given classified info by being careless, and that's a crime. And never proven. But my point being that all the way down the line, it has been. This is the cardinal sin of if you're an American, this is the top. This is what Republican congressmen have taught us. Here comes the president doing the exact same thing, and he's the president.
Look, if it is true, it's horrendous. If it's true, it's unacceptable. If it's true, we've all got to rise up and say, Trump, shut the hell up. I mean, come on. I'm not conceding.
By the way, I'm holding you to that.
Come on. I mean, if the guy is revealing kind of sensitive information, he's doing a profoundly bad job as our president.
847 says, if this is true, it's not a Republican or Democrat issue.
Right.
This is a USA issue. Troops on the ground are in peril. Our allies will not share intelligence with us. Our citizens are in peril. Not a political opportunity this time. It's the security of the United States.
That is almost word for word what I said in my Facebook page when I posted this thing at 4:30 in the afternoon. And I was saying, if he exposed sources and methods, individual sources can be compromised and that can lead to their death. And that's what you're dealing with when you're holding classified information. Well, so if people reveal classified information inappropriately, then they are putting individuals who helped us get that information mm-hmm. at risk of their lives.
It is worth remembering that when Donald Trump, right before his inauguration, Israeli intelligence officials were very worried. They were talking to the Obama administration. They didn't know what to do because they didn't feel they could trust this president to keep classified information classified.
There was a lot of talk at that time when he started getting the briefings.
Have had that concern from the start.
And so stories like this make us less safe. Stories like this put our troops in peril. Stories like this put our allies.
Only if they're
our
accurate. Only if they're accurate, David. You are putting way too much credit on media that you know has come up with fake stories, has blown stories, has misreported
stories. But they have not come up with fake stories.
You are plighting your trust.
That is your side of the aisle. That
you're plighting your trust,
news.
And you are walking down the aisle to marry the Washington
Name me
Post.
A fake story. Name me a fake story.
There are fake stories are out there
an
like,
actual,
like
no,
dandelions
it's,
on
it's
the
like
south lawn of the White
said,
House.
It's like Trump who said the polls were fake until he liked them. And the election was faked until he liked them. And the election was rigged until it was rigged in his favor. I mean, come on.
You
there
and I can
are
look
not
at the
fake
one.
News stories. And you're impugning journalism as a profession.
No, I'm not.
When you say things
I'm,
like
no,
that.
No, I'm not. I'm hardly... I, the son of two reporters, two noted reporters, I might point out, am not imputing journalism as a profession, all right? I, who received my own, you know, award in journalism and all this kind of stuff, recognition, I am not impugning journalism as a profession. I'm impugning practitioners.
Just every major news outlet.
No, I'm impugning practitioners who allow their personal political agendas to influence how they write and report the news, okay? And that has been going on in our country from the very beginning to today. And I believe that it is a serious impediment to putting credibility in the Washington
Post. I challenge
Post.
You, 60. Chris Roebling, to find me. I challenge you to come up with an actual fake news story Post or the Times or Reuters thought was fake.
630 says Watergate.
The fact is they don't think
that Watergate was broken by the Washington Post. The story was denied by everyone. I mean, that's what 630 says. So, I mean, are we at the point
when they
where
say,
and it took
on,
a year
on,
and a half?
Hold it. Watergate, I don't know if that person's old enough to remember Watergate. Watergate started with the unraveling of Watergate began with the very public arrest of the plumbers unit inside the Watergate office complex. Okay.
So an arrest.
That was reported by the Washington Post.
Right.
And then there went, as David says, there were 18 months of reporting, which were very, very difficult for the Washington Post and the New York Times and most everybody else in the Eastern journalism establishment abandoned the story. And the Post came up with a series of stories, and these now become pretty complicated, and I won't go into it, but some of them were corroborated,
right,
and some of them were denied. Okay, it is false to say that every story from the Post was denied. Some of them were instantly corroborated by independently
clean facts.
They were
denied by the White House.
They were not all denied by the White House. Some of them were understood by the White House to be true.
847 says the dossier that we just saw that was distributed right around election or
the Christopher Steele dossier.
That is has been routinely said to be false in some, but I think
no, actually that is a false statement. 847, with all due respect, many elements of the dossier have been confirmed through other intelligence sources.
Right.
For example, the Russian spy master out of Washington who had to leave in September because he was exposed as being the Russian spy master who was meddling in the elections. That was in the dossier. The dossier, all of it was denied.
What,
and then it turns
and
out that element.
He was directing the Trump campaign phone program.
What
the hell? These people get exposed
vote?
All the time. That is why we have an FBI.
No, he was
to
exposed
these people and
as
get
the
rid
guy
of them.
Interfering
you
in the
watch
election.
The Americans.
And that was in the dossier. Many, many, many things have been in the dossier that have been confirmed. Now, what hasn't been confirmed is the salacious stuff.
I think there are a few things in the dossier that have been confirmed. But the point is, if you want to read the Guardian article on the evolution of the dossier, I commend your attention to the Guardian article. Not that it's going to assuage David's desire for Trump's head on a pike, but the Guardian article talks about ways in which British intelligence fed ideas into a nexus of Western intelligence analysts, some of which led to the creation of the
847 has a last thought tonight, which I think is pretty good. It says, country over party. Also, sorry, Dave, Roebling's right about news outlets having a slant.
Yeah.
So it goes both ways.
Sorry, Dave.
It goes both ways.
I didn't say news outlets don't have slant. What I've said is they're not just making up these stories out of whole cloth.
Agreed. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, great Touche overtime
tonight. This is our bonus segment.
This bonus segment here on the download. Good conversation. Went a little overtime there with the boys from Touche, Roebling and Lundy. And they really broke it down there. There's it's funny, Pete. You know, you go to the overtime sesh, it starts to crystallize. I mean, who do you believe? If you're in one camp, you believe that, and you see this with the texts that are coming in as well, that there is a mainstream bias. There's a slant against President Trump. The establishment wants to take him down, and they're using the media, and they're almost become one. That they want President Trump and him being a change agent to lose, right? I mean, that's essentially the breakdown here, as opposed to, or is it, you know, in this search for truth and morality and the idea of what's right when you're in our government, when you're making our laws and you're not allowed to break rules and things that are put in place to protect servicemen, to protect taxpayers. You know, someone has to, there's checks there. The media's job is to take those unnamed sources and be able to tell a story to the American people, especially if those lawmakers are doing wrong. So that's an interesting division.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about division coming up here on the download. Our guests at the big table tonight, Brian Harrison and Melissa Michelson, we're going to talk with them about their new book, Listen, We Need to Talk. How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Now, this is, I set this up at the beginning. I mean, this book is as much about LGBT rights as it is any social issue. It really, truly is about the idea of how do you change one group's idea, opinion, point of view? Just how do you get a group, unentrenched? But this idea, I mean, we see it. We were just talking about it with Touche. If you're the president of the United States and you are a leader of a group and that group, and you continually tell that group, and he said it, that he uses Twitter in that way to talk to a certain, his crew. Fake news, fake news, fake news, fake news, fake news all the time. And so if you were going to do a poll right now, and you were going to an ABC News or wherever, and you were going to ask the question, do you believe that the mainstream media is objective? I would assume it would be a higher percentage of people saying no than ever before.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what we're going to talk about how you start to change attitudes for good and bad. We'll talk about them with them coming up. Also tonight, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about ghost restaurants in our industry night segment. This is really interesting. Technology is forcing restaurateurs and restaurant companies to rethink takeout and carryout because of services, delivery services and whatnot. The concept of being able to deliver food to you in 15, 20 minutes has prompted these restaurants to just go into the takeout business alone. Used to be that a carryout or a takeout was, you know, you'd go up to the guest counter at a restaurant and you'd say, hey, hi, it's Justin. I order for Justin, and you'd stand there while the restaurant's bustling around you. Well, they've found a way to create takeout-only businesses that really appeal to the delivery services and making sure you get your food delivered, and it's the right kind of food and the right packaging, that kind of thing, to change the way that delivery and carryout's done in this town. So we'll talk with Let Us Entertain You about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, the new play, which is at American Theater Company, called Tea, which is about Tanya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan, and the ice skating drama that captured our hearts, maybe, in 1994. I think it was 1994. We'll talk with them. They're mounting a show. It's somewhat of a comedy, but it's also, I think it's appropriate for our time. Another story of competition, jealousy, rivalries, and what have you. So we'll talk with the director who's in from New York. So we'll talk with her. And J.C. Brooks, Studio 435 tonight. So all that coming up. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's a beautiful Monday night, although we do have a thunderstorm watch for Kane County beginning. It's ending later tonight, but it's just a watch. It's not much consolation for people who might be in it right now, but there's rain in the area. But a nice night in downtown Chicago. Well, this past spring, the nation put out a poll suggesting that a majority of voters who voted for Donald Trump voted because of a fear of diversity. The findings say a majority of the Republicans that were polled said increased diversity was a negative. Now, when we say diversity, that usually falls along the lines of race. But more and more, that fear of diversity rears its head when it comes to issues of the LGBT communities. But a new book out on Oxford Press wonders why issues in the gay community, like marriage equality, have gone from nil in the public opinion to routinely accepted, especially in this age when we are so divided. How did attitudes change over decades and buck the trend of stable public opinion? For instance, legal abortions, the death penalty, those acceptance numbers have stayed the same over decades. But gay marriage, it went from 11% in 1988 to 60% acceptance in less than 20 years. The book is called Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Tonight, we talk about how to shift public opinion with the authors, Brian Harrison, who's a lecturer in political science at Northwestern University. Brian, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining me on the line is Melissa Michelson. She's a professor of political science at Menlo College. Melissa, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
All right. So where does this idea come from? I mean, is it essentially the idea that it's when you talk about a public poll and the idea of polling, we always see this public, it's just how we're asking the question, what the question's being asked of the people who are being polled?
Well, there's a little bit of that. I think you need to look at question wording. Depending on what you want the answer to be, you can ask the question that you will get that will get the desired answer. But really, the drivers of our work, it's twofold. One was we looked at public opinion change, and it was odd. It's not what we would expect. If you look at other issues, like you mentioned, they're generally stable over time. They don't change quickly in the aggregate. But this issue changed, you know, dramatically overnight. So on one hand, we wanted to know why. And on the other hand, so that was sort of our academic reason. Uh-huh. But on the other hand, as human beings who want to see expanded rights for LGBT people, we wanted to look for ways that can actually increase support for those who identify as LGBT. So the genesis of the project was sort of academic, and it was just practical. We want to see, you know, how do we help make the world a better place?
Right. Melissa, I mean, obviously throughout the book you talk about the reasons why, but I mean, there's a lot that goes in this, but at the same time, it is as simple as some of the leaders of social groups stepping forward and taking a stand, a pastor or a political leader. We saw with President Obama on gay marriage. But that seems to be a big part of changing the attitudes or the acceptance of a majority.
Exactly. So we're not manipulating public opinion by changing how we're asking it. It's more about who's talking about it and who's for it. And so if someone you look up to, someone you identify with, like your pastor or your president or a sports hero that you really admire, and they have a certain opinion, it makes you feel closer to them to share that opinion. And so you are more likely to change your mind and to be open to changing your mind if it's somebody you want to feel closer to.
You know, I think about that, and I think about politics, and a lot of times you'll have people make definitive statements. We see this with President Trump. We were kind of talking about it, Brian, just in the break about fake news. I mean, that's something that we're seeing play out even today. Or you see this idea of even, as I mentioned, President Obama talking about gay marriage. I mean, these are presidents. These are at the top. I mean, this is pretty obvious. But when you talk about leaders of social groups, and that's really what we're talking about here, who could they be? I mean, it's beyond presidents, political figures, pastors, et cetera.
So, well, my favorite experiment from the book uses Green Bay Packers Hall of Famer Leroy Butler to reach out to Packers fans.
Yeah, explain that.
Well, we did the experiment in Wisconsin, and of course there's quite a few people in Wisconsin who are fans of the Packers. And in one group of people, we told them that, and this is true, that Green Bay Packers Hall of Famer Leroy Butler supports same-sex marriage. And for the control group, we told them that Jay-Z does, and that is also true. And so, you know, they're both pretty famous black men, but only one of them is going to cue that shared identity, you know, of being a Packers fan, of being a Packers hero that, that these Packers fans would look up to. And so if a Packers fan was exposed to the statement from Leroy Butler, they were much more likely to say they support same-sex marriage, about 15 percentage points more likely than if they heard the statement from Jay-Z.
Well, I mean,
a huge effect, and you know, pretty simple manipulation. Just some local college students on the street handing out paper surveys.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, that is a tactic that is used by commercials and products. I mean, the idea of a celebrity endorsement. I mean, is it that simple? The idea that people look up to sports figures, celebrities, and others, and if they have an opinion, they share that opinion.
We know from
it's not just celebrity, because then it would have worked for Jay-Z.
Right.
It's something beyond that. It's that shared, strong identity of being a Packers fan. Just being a celebrity, just being famous, you know, then it wouldn't have worked.
Right.
Then it would have been the same.
So but it goes further than that.
It's that identity as a Packers fan.
Right.
And we know from social psychology that we sort of make sense of the social world by creating categories, and we're either in some and not in others. We like groups that we are in, and we tend to privilege those groups, and we tend to, if not openly dislike, at least not privilege groups that we're not in. So if you can appeal to what we have in common, and we can say, look at this thing, look at this identity that we both have. Like Melissa mentioned, people want to feel close to in-group members, and you can use that closeness to try to nudge them on other issues. It doesn't always work. It might work for brand awareness, for example, because people don't have strong opinions about brands. It may not work for some social and political issues because people have too strong of opinions about them. But as the book shows, it can work on occasion, and not every study in the book actually worked as we had thought.
Well, there was one that was interesting here in Illinois, Equality Illinois, the idea of sending out calls to try and get people interested, mostly in the black population, by mentioning Coretta Scott King. This is really interesting. Explain what you tried to do here.
So here in Chicago, we were lucky to work with Equality Illinois, which was graciously, you know, opening their headquarters to us for a couple days. And what we did is we went to them and we said, you know, who do you want to persuade? What minds do you want to change? And they said, we don't really know how to speak to the black community in Cook County in 2010. And we came up with a design to say, okay, let's try a couple things and see what might make an impact. And one of the things we tried was using black callers. So we know from existing work in academia,
the actual people who are calling,
people calling, if they're of the same race as the recipients of the call, they're going to be more likely to be supportive of whatever it is that they're asking on the phone. And that held true here in Chicago. We also additionally tried a quotation from Coretta Scott King, sort of making an appeal to her husband, saying, you know, if he were alive today, he would be supportive. And so we should be supportive as well. It actually didn't work as well as we had thought. It worked somewhat, but not as well as we had thought. So we replicated that same study in Georgia, and we sort of did the same thing, except at that point, we had the president of the United States we could use his quotation. We used his quotation. In that instance, the quotation worked very, very well. But the in-group prime of the shared race really didn't work. So it's a matter of sort of finding the right formula for our social group.
I mean, a lot of this, Melissa, has to, I mean, again, we find ourselves in tribes, and we find ourselves being political, dividing ourselves along political lines, Republican, Democrat. When you use President Obama or President Trump on the other side, automatically it seems to be goes back to that idea of the sort of shared, group social leader, you know, social group leader, who people will fall in line because they identify as Democrat or identify as Republican.
Absolutely. Partisanship is a powerful drug, and people are more likely to change their opinions than to change their partisanship.
Right.
And we see that over and over again, and we're, you know, seeing it today. So, yeah. So using political leaders, actually, the partisanship experiments we did were kind of the weakest ones, because it was really hard to get people to kind of go against their party.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're talking about other identity groups, then it's not quite as strong of a drug as partisanship is.
Well, it's obvious that it goes over partisan lines when you talk about an issue like gay marriage, because that's normally going to be one that if you call a select group of liberals or Democrats, they're going to say you're going to find a higher majority in that group. But this, I mean, to watch something that went from 10% or 11% to 60% acceptance over time, that is bipartisan. That has more to do with the fact that people are coming around on an issue than who they vote for.
And we see...
That's true, but we still have pretty high levels of disapproval among conservative Republicans and older Republicans. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for the holdouts on this issue, it does tend to be Republicans.
Brian, do you see, are there issues that are similar?
I just wanted to add one thing. Every social group, that every identifiable group is moving to be more supportive of marriage equality. It's just the rate at which they're changing. There's a poll that came out today that showed that 74% of Democrats and 71% of independents supported marriage equality. Only 47% of Republicans did. So I think, just to speak to our work, if there was a prominent Republican that came out in favor of marriage equality, maybe in the way that President Obama did, that might make a difference. It probably wouldn't, you know, jump to 74, but it certainly would make a difference. There really is no high-profile Republican, other than maybe Dick Cheney, who is maybe a murky Q in the Republican Party, but there aren't prominent Republicans who are supportive. But in terms of issues that are similar, I think the one that comes to mind is marijuana. Like, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, social and political issues generally are stable over time. People think what they think, and they like to be consistent. But marijuana use, both recreationally and medicinally, has changed remarkably quickly. And I think that's an issue where our theory of dissonant identity priming might apply really well. And I think there are others, but that's the first one that comes to mind.
Brian Harrison is in studio with me tonight. Melissa Michelson is on the line. We're talking about the book, Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. In studio with me tonight on The Download, the authors of Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Joining me in studio, Brian Harrison, a lecturer in political science at Northwestern University. Also on the phone, Melissa Michelson. She's a professor of political science at Menlo College. You know, this is a book that is not just about, as you mentioned at the top, LGBT rights. That's part of what you're talking about. But this is really pointing to one issue in our society that has shown a pattern of improvement when it comes to attitude. It's changed. I mean, this is, you poll in 1988 is different than 2016. And that's a very small amount of time. We're talking about 15, 20 years where you've seen a remarkable change in the attitudes of Americans. But this issue, Brian, and I have to ask, I mean, this is an issue that's as long as time, so this idea of accepting LGBT rights. So what do you look at to be the change? What changed in the last 15 years that wasn't available 100 years ago?
Sure. We don't want to give the impression that LGBT rights started in 1996 when the question about marriage equality started being asked routinely. Obviously, throughout the 20th century, LGBT rights have been a prominent American struggle. And so we can look back to the 1950s when we had the Lavender Scare and the president issued an executive order to purge the government of all homosexuals because they were a safety risk. We can look to a documentary in 1967 on CBS News that Mike Wallace did that was called The Homosexual, that talked about how the average gay man was, you know, lecherous and a danger to society. So there were decades and decades of struggle and fight and disease and some very dark times for the LGBT community. So I don't want to give the impression that, you know, magically, oh, look, everything is rosy. We don't ignore history. We don't want to ignore the last 80 years.
But why? I mean, yeah, there has been forces against change. You know, through you just mentioned two. I mean, huge, an executive order or a documentary that's seen on CBS. Those are huge deals. What was the change? What, in your estimation, when you look at this, what was it about this issue, marriage equality, gay marriage, that had such an explosion in 15 years' time?
I don't think there's one single thing. I think there's a variety of things. And one of them is LGBT people started coming out. And people realized, oh, my neighbor, my dentist, my kid's teacher, people in my world.
My family members
absolutely are LGBT. And that obviously changed minds. It's something that becomes more salient, more close to you. And so that's obviously one big thing. The second thing is non-LGBT people started speaking out in support too. And I really think that's when the tide changed. And that's really what the book is about, how social group leaders and social group members of groups other than LGBT coming out in support really changes the minds of that social group. We can also point to media portrayals, and there are more and more LGBT people in the media and more positively portrayed in the media. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of things.
Right.
And this book really focuses on the social group aspect.
All right, Melissa, I got a question about, I mean, this is what you guys are doing with the book, which is tremendous. the idea of looking at some of the social issues of our time and trying to sort of piece together a case study for why we've seen drastic change. I mean, in the book, you label it, it's extreme political science or experimental political science, right?
Right.
Talk about this concept, the idea of creating a new type of political science that will help understand how we change social issues in the future.
Well, experiments have kind of been at the forefront of political science research since 2000. It's a growing subfield where instead of just observing, we're kind of moving into the realm of quote-unquote real science or medical science, like how they do drug trials or they expose people to different messages. So it's, you know, it's not really that new because I guess now it's 2017, so it's been around for a decade and a half. But it's definitely kind of the trendy kind of political science to do experiments. It's also pretty new to do things that are involving the real world that are, you know, working in cooperation with advocacy organizations, doing things that are going to maybe affect the real world rather than just observe it. That's actually pretty controversial for some political scientists. They disapprove of work that is involved in the real world. And Brian and I, of course, are fans of that sort of thing. We're doing our work to change the world, not to just watch it. So it is a little bit different, but I don't want to overstate that because we are definitely following in the footsteps of some other folks that have been doing this sort of thing for the last decade and a half.
Both of you in this book, I mean, to take on the idea of social groups or identity theory and to really sort of put names to some of the things of why, as human beings, we group up and decide what we like and what we don't like. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, but a lot of this book, Brian, and this is the fun part about it is really starting to break down, you know, everything for, I mean, what it takes to change attitudes, one of which is persuasion. You know, we talked about this idea of social group leaders and persuasion plays a big part. But at the end of the day, when you're just talking about the practical uses, I mean, it's simple sort of kindergarten type stuff where you're like, you know, one of the for instance, one of the staples in the book, if you want to begin this process of changing attitudes, there needs to be a willingness to listen.
Absolutely. And that is an academic construct and it's a practical one, right? If you're trying to persuade someone of something, if you're saying something to them in order to change their mind, if they don't listen to you, if they don't think what you're saying is important to them or relevant to them, if they don't believe what you're saying, obviously what you're saying is going to have no effect.
Right.
So the book really looks at the ways that we can make information relevant to people in ways that it may not otherwise be. By simply saying, you know, listen, we need to talk about the things we have in common rather than the things that we have in difference. So, you know, you're sitting at the Thanksgiving table and, you know, your drunk Uncle Larry says something crazy. You can say to your family, no, you know, people like us shouldn't tolerate that kind of homophobia or people like us don't believe those kinds of things.
And Melissa, I'll give you the last word on this, but I mean, it is interesting because this really does have to do, I mean, it's political science, but it's also human science in the way that we do group up. I mean, there's this us versus theirs. There's, you know, you mentioned it at one point just about the idea of this is identity theory. You're either with a group or you're against a group. How do you change attitudes when you're really going against what we know to be human nature?
Well, you got to use human nature, not go against human nature. And so it's all about finding that link with people so that they don't dismiss what you have to say and so that they do listen to you. And, you know, that's not always obvious. You might not necessarily know whether the best way to reach out to somebody is through their religious identity or their sports fan identity or, you know, some other identity that they hold very strongly. But if you can find that connection, you know, maybe you both really like opera. Maybe you both have the same favorite TV show. You find a way to connect with someone. You make that human connection. And then once they're listening to you, then you can start having a persuasive conversation.
Melissa Michelson is a professor of political science at Menlo College. Brian Harrison, a lecturer in political science at Northwestern University. Their book is called Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. I want LGBT rights, excuse me. Brian, Melissa, thanks so much for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Coming up, we're going to talk about ghost restaurants. This is a fascinating trend, and it really is springing up thanks to delivery services like Uber Eats or Grubhub, that restaurants are opening, it's kind of exploding all over Chicago, just takeout windows. There's no restaurant. It's not a, you can't go in there and eat. It's just brick and mortar. So you're seeing more Let Us Entertain You and places that are actually just opening up windows because people are using these delivery services and they're not necessarily wanting to go out to eat. They want the food. And we had Stephanie Eisner in here, Pete, and we talked about the idea that takeout is tough because they'll make something that they think is going to be eaten in 5 minutes and it doesn't get somewhere till 30 minutes and it's soggy or it's cold and then people complain and they have a problem with the brand that is, you know, and that's something that more and more restaurants are recognizing. So they're coming up with this concept of ghost restaurants, which aren't real restaurants. They're essentially takeout windows. So we'll talk about that with Let Us Entertain You coming up here in the 9:30 segment. We'll open it up this week as a world premiere at American Theater Company. It's called Tea. It's a play that is in the competitive ice skating saga genre. Of course, it tells the famed story of Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding, a classic American tale of fierce competition, jealousy, and triple axel jumps. The play wraps up the season for ATC. T is written by Dan Abel and it's directed by Margot Bordelon. Bordelon is a New York director by way of Chicago. She once worked at Looking Glass, Steppenwolf, Collaboration, just to name a few. She's back in Chicago for this play, and she joins me tonight on the download. Margot, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, yeah, I kind of joke around about the competitive ice skating saga genre, but this story is one that everyone who's listening right now knows. America knows it very well. It's a story that that has had parodies and musicals and everything in between. Why get involved with this project? What is it about telling this story to a theater audience?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you would say that this story has been told through musical and parodies. When Will first approached me with this play, Will Davis, who's the artistic director of American Theater Company, I assumed that it was camp because it lends itself to that. But Dan has written a really fierce, muscular, language-driven play, and that was really intriguing to me. I think that it walks this delicate balance between being comedy and drama. I guess I would call it a kind of stylized black comedy that's really language driven.
Yeah.
So that was really intriguing for me. It feels like a real Chicago play. It's five actors. It's really, you know, meaty roles for them.
As a director, do you have, when you have the script in front of you, and obviously it goes in a direction, but as a director, do you have to find yourself navigating the tone of not trying to go into sort of campville when you're talking about a story that has been so tremendously camped, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Dan's script and his words makes it easy to not veer into camp. He really takes the characters seriously. It's important to him that we have great sympathy for these characters. And so that feels really clear on the page. That said, it's the 90s. It's the early 90s. There are these costumes that are authentic to the time, and yet just encountering them now feels like comedy.
Not to even mention the ice skating costumes, which are probably something
exactly.
Else.
There's right. only one ice skating costume that appears, but it's reason to see the show right. just for that. So,
well,
yeah.
I, it's funny because seeing this play coming out and, you know, the idea of talking about Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan and that, it automatically, I mean, your brain automatically goes to, okay, this is going to be a campy story making fun of this ridiculous story that just kind of took over the zeitgeist for a moment and stuck with us, unfortunately, thanks to Jay Leno and company for decades, right?
Right.
But when you really think about the story, I mean, it is one that is sort of a classic, almost Shakespearean tale. In this way that, you know, the jealousy plays, hired hitmen, this fierce rivalry to be better than, and maybe it's not even about the person that they're trying to be better than. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this story if you can peel back the camp.
I think that's right. I think that what Dan's script does really beautifully is it kind of dollies back and analyzes these larger questions about gender and class And it's we're at this interesting moment right now where all of these stories from the 90s are being reinvestigated.
Yeah, right.
We have Confirmation, which was the HBO film about Anita Hill. We have the OJ series that have just come out.
Right.
And what's interesting about those stories is the question at the center of those is one of guilt. Like, you know, did OJ do it? Did Clarence Thomas do it? But what's interesting about this script is Tanya's guilt is not a question. She's very complicit in the act of Nancy being taken out. And so I think what he's trying to do is ask this larger question, which is when you start out many steps behind, what do you actually have to do to become number one? And that's where I really felt personally connected to the piece, just these larger questions about class. You know, Tanya Harding was super athletic. She was scrappy. She was blue collar. She was not the image that the U.S. Ice Skating Association wanted to put forward. Nancy Kerrigan was all of those things. She was this kind of classic ice princess.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tanya had to work a little hard for it. So I think one of the bigger questions I hope that the play, that the production asks is, was Tanya totally off base in allowing her husband to put forward this plot? Or did she actually need to cheat to even have a shot at the gold?
Well, that's fascinating. See, it's Shakespearean.
It is. I think of it as Greek. I think of it as Greek. I think hubris plays such a huge role in this story.
I mean,
it's classic. Yeah.
It's a good play for you to come back to Chicago for. I mean,
oh, yeah, it's wonderful.
So you're in New York City. We're talking with Margot Bordelon. She's a director. She's directing Tea, which is on stage starting this week, right? It starts Thursday?
Yeah.
Thursday night at the American Theater Company, 1909 West Byron in North Center. Yeah, you spent years here in Chicago working at some of the theaters I mentioned, Looking Glass, Steppenwolf, Collabor Action. Talk about making the transition to New York to be a director in New York City. What is that like? What does it mean coming back home to do this?
It's a beautiful, wonderful, warm. I'm being such a Pollyanna, but it's true. Coming back to Chicago is, you know, just wonderful. I spent all of my 20s here. I feel like this particular theater community really shaped who I am as a theater artist. This is a city of ensembles, and that feels so important to the core of who I am as a theater artist. New York is exciting and filthy and glittering and but it's a different kind of hustle there. It's definitely people are looking out for number one, and I think great relief and comfort and excitement of coming back to Chicago community.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, there's so much made, and we talked to a lot of different theater artists on this program just about the Chicago theater scene. And I think, you know, we talk about theater a lot on The Download. And ultimately, what we're trying to get at is what makes it tick. That's unique about Chicago, and being able to pull from those and say that's the same maybe in sports, maybe that's the same in politics, but there is over and over people talk about community ensemble and being able to take a risk. Are those real things? Is that real since you were here and now you're in New York City, especially juxtaposed against your professional life now in New York City? Those concepts, do those resonate to you?
They do. I mean, I come back here. I mean, I'm trying to answer this honestly and not just be completely overwhelmed by nostalgia being back here, because that's certainly an element of it. But I do think that there's a generosity of spirit and a willingness and openness to collaborate that exists here that is different than New York. And part of it is because I think, and again, I'm kind of like a newbie in New York. I have yet to even be there 4 years, but there does seem to, it feels more commercially driven. It feels like even if you have a hit downtown New York show, there's still a possibility that it could go to Broadway. Whereas in Chicago, it feels like there's a real commitment, not just from the actors, but from directors and playwrights alike, that you're really in it for the work. Mm-hmm. And you're really in it to investigate this particular piece that you're working on. And there's just an honesty to that I really miss, and I really appreciate being back.
You know, I'll ask you this, I mean, as we're being honest, I mean, I'll ask a question. Is it difficult to be in theater in New York City? I mean, how hard is it? How challenging? I don't make it hard, but I mean, a lot is made in Chicago about, you know, it's affordable to live here. You know, it's another thing. There's a community. People hang out together. I mean, talk about that juxtaposed to New York. I mean, for people who may be listening and like, I want to go to New York and do theater. I mean, is it a challenge?
Oh, my God. Absolutely. Yeah, it really is. You know, I transitioned there out of grad school, and I did the MFA directing program at Yale. So a lot of my colleagues were going straight to New York. Mm-hmm. And it was a real debate for me whether or not I wanted to come back to Chicago or whether I wanted to go to New York. I had a lot of relationships with designers who went straight to New York, and I really wanted to continue to cultivate those. But what's been interesting is in the last 12 months I've been living in New York, I've actually been living in New York 4 of those months. And the other 8 of the months I've been out of town. I've been doing regional stuff. Which for me suits me really well. I kind of enjoy living out of a suitcase. I like my drifter life. but it's not for everyone, you know. Right. If people are married or they have children, I think that would be more difficult. But yeah, I kind of enjoy being on the road.
Well, I mean, even beyond the road, and I always, we talk about this too. We just had talking to Richard E. Grant about this. He's on stage at My Fair Lady, just about the concept that theater. And art in general, but namely theater, you can have a success in a hit show that runs for 6 months and then you're out of work.
Totally, it's very unstable.
It's a strange career. I mean, it's a very fulfilling career. It's artistic, but in the same regard, I mean, you're working project to project. I mean, even if the project, you get the chance to work with Will at American Theater Company, and that show will be over in June.
That show is over for me in a week. Like, I leave after opening and they run, but yeah, my job's done.
How do you mentally prepare for a life in which you are constantly doing that kind of work?
I don't know. This time has been a great time of soul searching for me while I've been in Chicago. Asking myself this very question is, how long can I be okay with the instability of a freelance life? It's super exciting. If somebody called me in a week and said, we have this production, we want you to be here in 2 weeks, I could go do it. And that has happened in the last few years. And it has been thrilling to be able to do that. But it doesn't feel sustainable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, life is a lot about choices as well. So you may take this one and someone also calls at the same time and says, we have another directing job and you have to make choices.
Yeah.
Fascinating. All right. So back to tea.
Yeah.
What is it about this? What is it about this play, working with Will at American Theater Company, but also the doing a play like this that attracts you? What are you looking for in your career? I mean, you get the opportunity, you know, as you get more and more credits under your name, to pick and choose what you want to work on. So, what is it about this play, and specifically, what do you want to be involved with as a theater artist?
I mean, I love working on new plays. I consider myself a new play director. I think there are directors out there who love to do classic work, love to do, you know, Shakespeare, the Greeks, et cetera, et cetera. There are directors who love to do musicals or opera. But for me, I feel my most alive and most engaged when I'm working with playwrights on new plays, because you are putting something out there into the world for the very first time. If it's new, it's hopefully speaking to what is going on right now in our culture. I think we need constantly new American voices that are providing us some kind of commentary or questions about these times that we're living through. So it's been really wonderful to have the opportunity to work with Dan on this play. He's super smart. I respect the hell out of him. I really feel like we have this very solid kind of lateral relationship in the room. It's also such an honor to be working under Will. Will and I go back over a decade, which is sort of frightening to say, but also great. I feel like I'm at that point now in my career where my friends are now taking over theaters, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's just such a pleasure to be working with collaborators who I really respect and trust. And this play in particular just feels like a interesting challenge for me in the way that it is this very language-driven play. I can only, you know, we're in the middle of tech. It's yet to be seen what will happen.
So
I have high hopes, but
tech reverses
the best. I really hope that I'll do Dan's Play justice.
Well, I appreciate you stepping out of tech rehearsal to come talk with us.
Of course.
The play is called Tea. It opens Thursday at American Theater Company, 1909 West Byron in North Center neighborhood. It's directed by Margot Bordelon, written by Dan Abel. It's a story of Tanya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan, and that American slash Greek tale of jealousy, competition, and, of course, triple axel jumps. Margot, thanks so much for being my guest tonight, and good luck with the play.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks.
All right, coming up. We're going to talk with Bill Nevroos. He's a partner at Seasides as well as the restaurant Oyster Bar. Let us entertain you place up in Lincoln Park. We're going to talk about ghost restaurants, part of our industry night segment. It's coming up right here after the news. And coming up 10 o'clock, Studio 435, J.C. Brooks. Yeah! All right, coming up, we'll talk ghost restaurants. In Studio 435, we've got J.C. Brooks. Excited to have him back on the show. I will say Mother's Day was great. I had a fun time. I also wanted to let everyone know once again that I appreciate all of your concern and your advice on the rabbits. I think I got it. I did a bunch of sprays, geraniums, marigolds, hot sauce and vinegar, some animal controls. I mean, there's so much spray. I don't know what, I mean, people just can smell my little front yard from a mile away, and the rabbits know it, that it's not unacceptable. The only thing I don't have is a rubber snake. I need to go tomorrow and find a rubber snake. I'm going to head out to the... Where do you get a rubber snake? Do you get it like at... My Uncle Fun's gone, right?
Maybe so, like Five Below?
Yeah.
Dollar store?
Yeah. I need to find a rubber snake and a plastic coyote. And I need to climb a tree and put a plastic owl up there, too. There's a lot of things I still need to do, but I thank everybody for their suggestions and advice. All right, so there, we're good, right? Everyone good? Good. I'll let you know if they eat it. If they eat it, there will be another big segment on what to do about these darn rabbits.
You know what's going to happen? You're going to go pick up the rubber snake, and on the package, it's going to say not recommended for scaring off rabbits.
My issue is, I'm just afraid that the sprays are going to hurt the plants. You know, like, because they're just brand new, they're in there, so I'm just like, you know, you just hate to spray anything on a plant, so.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, well, thank you, buddy. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, time for Industry Night, our weekly look inside the world of food and hospitality in the Chicago region. With the explosion of delivery services and the fact that customers don't have to go wait in line for anything these days, it's led to a new trend in ghost restaurants. What's a ghost restaurant? Well, it's a fancy way of saying takeout window only. Now, a lot of these windows are attached to existing restaurants, but the menus are different and the experience is too. This isn't reserved just for hot dogs or pizza. Nope, now you're seeing more and more high-end restaurants get in the game, whether it's restaurants like Bar Sienna or Duck Duck Goat in the West Loop, or Seaside, a new window opened by Let Us Entertain You, attached to their Lincoln Park restaurant, Oyster Bar. It's definitely picking up steam. Joining me to talk about the new trend of ghost restaurants is Bill Nevroos. He's a partner at Seaside, as well as the main restaurant, Oyster Bar, and he's in studio. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Ghost restaurants. All right. So, I mean, it's about time that the culinary industry, the more high-end restaurants, caught up to pizza shops, things like that.
Right. Yeah. They've been doing it right. They expanding their restaurant size, like beyond the seats in the restaurant. It's kind of the way the pizza places kind of make their hay, right?
Right. Obviously, we've heard a lot about the idea of more and more restaurants getting into delivery, or you can come take out. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, some of the high-end restaurants will do delivery, but you can take out. But what we always see is, inevitably, somebody standing in the middle of this restaurant or you know, maybe you're by the cash register and waiting, trying to get a server's attention and not sure, and you're in the middle of this. Hey, it's about time that something like this started to pick up steam.
Yeah, you know, and I think that one of the hurdles that most people kind of come into is they open these restaurants, and I do the same thing, and we build this great restaurant, and then later we decide, like, how are we going to do carryout business? So we get a little greedy, and we want to do more sales, right?
Right.
And so I think what we did here differently was we said, let's do a carryout restaurant and let's design everything around the carryout experience. And it's amazing the different things you can do if you're not beholden to serving food on a plate in a restaurant with servers.
Right, you can do some different things. What can you do differently? I mean, what can you – I mean, to open up a window on the side of your restaurant, what kind of things are there that aren't necessarily on the menu?
Well, you can design the food first where it has to be good, you know, 20 minutes after you make it. And you start to limit your options, right? And so, like we decided, what we talked about earlier, pizza, like it's great 20 minutes after you make it. Sometimes it's even better the next day, right? So we designed the menu specifically to hold for 20, 30 minutes even. We picked the packaging especially for that. And it allows us then to get good food into customers' homes without worrying about, you know, how fast did this driver get into our place? You know, it's all important. But we have a little bit of a leeway.
As a partner, you got to think about the bottom line. I mean, a lot of people will choose at their restaurant just the same items because that's what they have. And that the overhead is the same. They don't have to mess with things. It's just more going out. Why change it? And what are the pressures and the challenges put on a restaurant to come up with another menu to serve this audience?
Right. So to limit all those challenges, when we made the menu small. And what we found was when you order takeout from a lot of restaurants, and the research that I did, those restaurants are serving 90% of their volume off of 10% of their menu. But everybody wants to make the net as big as possible, so their menu keeps getting bigger and bigger. And so what we decided to do was have a 9-menu item and just go for that 90% of volume. And so it makes it easier to execute. We designed the menu around the current kitchen equipment, how it balances with the current menu mix. So we can execute it without adding any additional personnel in the restaurant. That's the, you know, it hinges all on that, right? So you can do the extra volume without adding extra people.
You guys, you at Seaside, but also Lettuce and other places, I mean, it feels like this was almost a challenge that's forced upon you guys based on the delivery services that have come up, the Grubhubs or the Uber Eats or whatever, all the way down the line, thousands of them just popping up. And they're going to get the food regardless.
Right.
You know, they're coming to Oyster Bun regardless. I mean, they're going to, they said, we're picking up some oysters, we're doing this. Eventually, at the end, it's your customer that suffers in the way that they get something 30 minutes later and it doesn't hold up or whatever. And so, talk about your relationship with the delivery services and how they've changed the industry that you work in.
Right. So, they certainly have, and their market share is growing. And, you know, all you have to do is read any weekly New York Times article or Wall Street Journal article, and it tells you the ups and downs and ebbs and flows of these major players. We gravitate towards doing more business with the ones that are more heavily invested in customer service and reacting to their customers and training their drivers.
Can you keep, as a restaurant, can you keep services away from you, like that you don't like, that you've had bad experiences
certainly.
With? Really?
Certainly. So we make the
decision
to be a partner with them, and so you can't just – hey, I'm going to go pick up from my favorite restaurant and use my favorite company unless the two are doing business together. And so we choose our companies wisely. And, you know, there's some leverage in being who we are that we get to because we have the power of a lot of restaurants together to make sure that our customers are getting certain drivers and treated a certain way.
We're talking about the idea of ghost restaurants, which essentially take out windows only, with Bill Nevruz. He's the partner at Seaside, which is a window up on north side of Lincoln Park, which is attached to the main restaurant, Oyster Bod. So Let Us Entertain You place. I think about the delivery services because there has just been, like we talked about, an explosion of really just changing the game. And people coming in and being able, I mean, we're at a point in our society now where, I mean, it's okay for me to pick up my phone, press three buttons, and something from Seaside's going to be at my door in 20 minutes.
Right.
I mean, I don't have to exchange money. I don't have to give money to the delivery driver. I mean, it's changed drastically. You've been in the business for a while. Is it a good thing that this is happening? I mean, for someone who's in restaurants and even opening up carryout windows, is it a good thing for the business for Let Us Entertain You?
I think it's a great thing. Any advancement in technology has some pains to it. But it's a great thing. Anything that can get our product into people's mouths faster, easier, cheaper.
But you guys aren't. I mean, lettuce is. I mean, I know. I think of Maggiano's is a good example of a place for a long time that's had that like little side thing over on Clark Street where, you know, you go on the side.
Right.
But I mean, most of the lettuce territories, I don't think of as the place I'm going to go necessarily to get carry out. And if I do, they don't have a window associated to it.
You'd be surprised. It's the fastest portion of our business.
Really?
It's growing so quickly. You know, I don't know whether it's a combination of people just running out of time, so they don't want to, you know, they're going to eat, they're going to eat good. It's a generational thing. There's a lot of different factors that go into it, but I know it's a growing part of our business. It's a good thing.
Do you, as a restaurateur, do you find yourself, as you start to think about new concepts and new places, thinking carryout first?
The only time I've ever thought carryout first is with Seasides, because it's carryout only.
Right.
And unless you're the pizza place, and then you think carryout, like A, 1B. For our dine-in restaurants, our full-service restaurants, you always have to think the experience first in the restaurant.
Do you think there'll be a time in our future where restaurants as high caliber and let us entertain you in other places just do carryout windows? There's no attached restaurant that they live on their own and they serve a certain purpose just to play in that new sort of world, the Uber world?
That's an interesting thought. I think it will come up in a certain price point first and probably a cheaper price point where it's a full service, right. You know, only carryout. But I think that Seasides is a perfect example of high quality food. It's at a price point where you know there's quality being served. And I don't have any intentions on building a brick-and-mortar restaurant. This is only for pickup. I do have intentions of opening a different pickup point later this month in Schaumburg. You know, the idea is that we have, you know, there is a lot of restaurants in our company, over 100. And some percentage of them would be a good fit to have a pickup point for Seaside. So we'll see if that happens.
That's amazing to think about when you say pickup points. Because if you start to think of restaurants like UPS, you're going to start creating pickup points everywhere mm-hmm. for the same product, meaning it's not necessarily open up a new restaurant, but just different pickup points to pick up that so it serves a bigger part of the audience.
Right. You know, I'm of the age where I remember I got my first ATM card when I was in high school, I think. My parents gave me an account. And to go to an ATM machine, you had to go to your bank.
Yeah, right.
And it was, you know, into the lobby of the bank. And then, you know, years later, it's a ubiquitous little ATM sign on any convenience store in America. And there are probably some people that don't even know what ATM stands for. But they go in and they see it and they know they can get money there. And so hopefully when people see our Seasides pickup point, at some point they recognize, hey, that's where I can get that Seasides. And they mark it and, you know, we'll do some geo-tracking so people can find it on their phones without even knowing where it is.
That's going to scale. I mean, the next step is going to be how you guys use the information, where people are picking up from mm-hmm. The delivery service. Do you share the delivery service? Do they share the data with you of where the deliveries are going to and things of that nature to yeah. make the experience even more customizable?
We are absolutely working together. You know, yeah. it serves the delivery company to serve more.
Wow.
Right? So we both have the same goal.
Ah, I love it. The future of food right here.
Right.
You heard it right here from Bill Nevruz. He's a partner at Seasides as well as his main restaurant, Oyster Bar, both in Lincoln Park. We're talking about ghost restaurants, the idea of takeout windows only, most of which are still attached to restaurants. But we're going to see, I have a feeling in the next couple of years, you're going to see takeout windows only mm-hmm. in Chicago and elsewhere. Bill, thanks for being here. Thanks for being for my guest and telling us all about this.
Yeah, thanks, Justin.
Of course, the texts that come in, they say, here's a good question. There was one that said, you know what I hate? I hate, where is it at? Yeah, 773. I hate going to restaurants and having a group of drivers just hanging around the front door. And that's true, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that is becoming an issue. Like, I think of a couple of restaurants that I love. Scarola comes to mind, La Scarola.
Mm-hmm.
I love that place. And whenever I order carryout, the only problem I have is I'm like, it's a packed restaurant. And so you have to go to the back to the cash register.
Yeah, it's a hassle.
Like, yeah, and it's just like, but it's a hassle in a good way because you end up standing there looking at everybody eating. You know, because they wait and they're like, 1 second, it's about ready. So you just stand in the middle of the restaurant. You stand there next to somebody's chair. Hey, how's it going? Yeah, leaning in the wintertime, the jackets are hanging off the thing. It's just like your knee resting against their winter jacket. Real nice. No, but then the other person, this is 847, do people tip on carryout-only meals? So what's the percentage if you do? I don't know, man. That is a question I don't even think our researchers tonight from Northwestern could answer. I think you have to figure that out on your own. Because there was a couple of years I'm like, I was in a staunch no tip carryout. Mm-hmm. Now I round up, probably do $2 or $3.
Yeah.
Just so they think I'm cool.
A little something.
Yeah. So they look at me like, hey, man, you get it.
Yeah.
I guess. I'm not sure what I'm tipping for.
What about when, like, if you go to a coffee shop and
you get a coffee.
The person rings you up, but it's not the same person that
made the drink.
Makes the coffee. But I assume that they pool all the tips.
Do. Yeah, they do.
So I'm sure in this case, they probably pool tips as well.
I'm old school. What I like to do is I'll go to the Starbucks and be really crowded, you know, and order the drink from the bar, like a latte. And I go over there, and when they call, they go, Justin, I come up and I shake the guy's hand and I palm him a dollar. Thanks, Rick. Hey, Rick, this is for you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. That's what I do. Wouldn't be an awesome bit to do, like over and over? Because they're so busy and they're moving on to the next drink. It would be great to like try to get their eye contact, slip them a dollar. I think that they would appreciate that. Coming up, Studio 435 tonight. I'm excited. J.C. Brooks, J.C. Brooks Band. Bob's got all the wires out tonight. There's a lot of percussion. I'm excited. The double keyboard, too. Not just a single, double. This looks great. I'm excited. I've always, you know, JC was on before. Always love when he's here. It's funny because so many people have reached out like, oh, JC Brooks coming through.
Excited.
It is. That's always. It's fun. It's good. It's a good Studio 435 rock. And it's a perfect night to rock Michigan Avenue, too. The showcase
people
studio.
Are out. People are be, out.
I feel bad for the
window.
Yeah, the bands who were in Studio 435 in January.
Yeah,
you know, it's raining sideways. Traffic. Nobody's out there, and they're like having to conjure up some energy to the audience at home. Here, you'll actually get people that surround the windows to watch. You know, so the summer we should really use that to our advantage. So like we only get the hot bands in the summertime because we could promise them nicer opportunity to play for the tourists on Michigan Avenue. Yeah, for bands that we don't like necessarily, but, you know, someone handed down. And we go, we'll give you January. You get February.
Yeah, we can pitch it like that. There's a possibility 5 or 6 Michigan Avenue stragglers.
They're going to love it.
Will come and listen and buy your music.
Yeah, like if my uncle reaches out and he's like, hey, I've got that fiddle band. I'd love to have you on. I'll be like, well, you can come through in February, Uncle Ron. Actually, we have a fiddle. Is the fiddle group tomorrow?
Yeah, Big Sadie.
Big Sadie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great. That's exciting. Yeah, we got a great show tomorrow. Tomorrow is Chicago Community Trust's On the Table. We talked about this a couple years in a row now, and you may have been a part of it at some point. This is a great movement by Chicago Community Trust to hold breakfasts, lunches, and dinners throughout Chicagoland area with community members getting together to talk about the issues. They pay for the dinner. People host it, you know, and then I've been invited to them. I've talked to Daniel Ash about it on air a couple times. But it's a well-known thing. It's become sort of, you know, if you can bring in a bunch of people who can talk about the issues over food, you know, that's a good way for people to sort of get to know each other in the community. So we're going to do one in studio tomorrow night from the big table. A couple of community leaders are going to come in.
We're bringing in food?
I just realized as I was just saying this, I had not thought about that part. So you and I are going to have to hop
to Seasides, carry out.
That's right. We could do that. We may have to go into the prize closet and be like, hey, is there any way to get one of those gift certificates to Lou Malnati's tonight? See,
we got an extra large Blackhawks t-shirt I'm sure we could.
Yeah, maybe that's what we'll do. Change it. So usually On the Table is about food and having, but we'll change it so you just get a free Blackhawks t-shirt instead of food. I think that works. Does that work?
That works.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly segment, bringing you some of the best live music Chicago has to offer in our Allstate Showcase studio, which is turning into a jam session tonight. We got some good stuff lined up tonight. One of my faves, one of Chicago's faves, the soul singer-songwriter J.C. Brooks, the J.C. Brooks Band. J.C. Brooks has been part of the Chicago music scene for a couple decades now. He's part of the J.C. Brooks and the Uptown Sound, of course, his solo career as well. He's releasing new music with his band. The new album is called The Neon Jungle. It can be found on all the streaming sites. J.C. Brooks Band is about to head out on tour. Their next gig in Chicago is going to be June 2nd at Joe's on Weed Street. J.C. Brooks, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me in. Oh, my decades on the Chicago music scene. We've just, I mean, decade. God, it's starting to get there.
Because we
makes
played,
you feel old, though.
I remember Schadenfreude and J.C. Brooks at a show together at the Hideout. It would have been 2008. And you guys were already, you guys were long in the tooth at that point.
No, we just started in 2007. Yeah.
That's a year. It's still a year.
Oh, God, anyway, is that long for bands?
It's a long time. Well, let's talk about this new music. I mean, you've got a new album out. I listened to it. It's great. I didn't realize it when I listened to it. It's funny because the bio says it's an album-length depiction of one crazy, incredible night out. I didn't read that till now. Like, okay. I read that and sort of like, oh, that's what the album is. But talk about the concept of writing this record and putting it out sort of on the idea of a great night.
Initially, when we started writing the follow-up to Howl, it was Howl is, I love it. I think it's personally some of my best work lyrically. But it's such a melancholy album. And
Right.
And we wanted to write something that was more fun, more party vibe, and that's kind of how we got into this. And we started talking Chicago nightlife, and then as we were writing, I kind of was able to mentally like weave these songs into a like linear narrative, and that's kind of how it all came together. And unfortunately, that isn't as represented in the current track list right now, because, you know, we wanted to give it a little bit more more of a sonic dynamic than necessarily a narrative one.
Yeah, I mean, you're a longtime musician. I mean, how important is it for you to find a nice partnership or collaboration with the musicians to make an album come to life? Because you may have an idea where you're like, all right, here's the 11 songs I want to do.
Yeah.
But there are producers and other people who are like, you know what, you really want track three to jam, or you want, you know, slow it down. How important is it to have that kind of conversation?
It's really important, because when you're working on something, you can get, you know, you're up close all the time, and having an outside eye is, it just gives you some perspective whether or not you take that advice. So I think it's super important to always be open to those voices and to these suggestions, because at the end of the day, some people want to make an album that's purely them, you know, purely that individual, and they don't care, you know, whether it is accessible or good or not. And I just want to make something that people can enjoy. That's kind of been our thing since the beginning.
Yeah,
is
right.
Just come on in, you know, put a pin in your problems and enjoy this, and then pick them back up whenever you're done with us.
But I mean, I've already had texts tonight that have said, you know, oh, J.C. Brooks, I love J.C. Brooks. I love going out to see J.C. Brooks, because you've been a staple on the Chicago music scene, the indie scene, for years now, with the band before and now with your band. I mean, talk about the, I mean, let's just say instead of multiple decades, let's say 10 years or so. But, I mean, talk about how it's changed. I mean, for you to be rocking out Joe's on Weed Street or Double Door in its heyday or Hideout or anything like that. I mean, do you noticed the change in Chicago at being sort of a veteran of the scene now?
I wouldn't say that I notice a change so much. You know, the scene is the scene is the scene. But I would say, you know, obviously venues are changing. We just took a big hit this past year with the Double Door, but I don't know. It's, Yeah, Chicago's always had a great sense of community in its various artistic scenes because, you know, mm-hmm. I come from the theater world too,
right,
and there is always this kind of cohesion, and I don't want to say non-competition, but it's there is definitely a lot more community than I've seen in other places, so it keeps it from feeling too much like this thing that is changing or spinning out of control or anything like that, you know. And mm-hmm. it's not like there's been some like huge Chicago, like, oh, remember when like crumping happened and, you know, and all the Southern rap was on fire, you know. It's like there hasn't been a huge game changing shift in the
style,
industry in
right,
that way
right,
or style
right,
that
right.
way. So no, it doesn't feel like, not to say that things aren't evolving, but it doesn't really feel like some sweeping, shocking, you know, gasp change because yeah, it's a really supportive
well,
community.
I will say this. I mean, I think of your sound and it's evolved. I mean, for what you do now, I mean, listening to all day to Neon Jungle, I mean, the stuff that I mean, it's a different genre of music. I mean, what you played with Uptown Sound,
sure.
and that was a little bit more soul kind of straight ahead. But this definitely feels like a more mature project. It's not just playing the songs that you know, the sort of rhythm and blues kind of songs that I don't know, that you came up with, but they seem to be a little bit more about you.
Yeah, it definitely is. It is a little bit more reflective of kind of my style and energy, but it's also reflective of the entire group, because this album was written as we were just becoming a group. You know, this is we are not the Uptown Sound, but we are still. You know, we grew into that. It's not like it was like goodbye Uptown Sound, all new band
right here.
Right. So, but it was us really learning how to write together because we didn't all write as a band back in the Uptown Sound days. So I think that while the energy I feel is like more reflective of who I am, I love that the album does sound like so many things, because it was, you know, us bringing all of our stuff to the table and then extruding it through what we do and how we sound. So,
what I love about the record, and not to call out, but I mean the keys are great. I mean, there's really the synth sound that I don't know. There's something it's like you said. I mean, the record that you had before was a little bit more you sort of. In a slower kind of, it was a dark record.
yeah, and it was definitely but, me at the
yeah,
time.
But yeah. I mean, how often as a musician do you find yourself? Does your music reflect where you're at in your life at that time?
It kind of has to, you know. I mean, if you're writing from an honest place. Granted, this album reflects where I was about, you know, like a year ago to now.
Specifically on one night, right?
Yeah. But it's one night in 1987. So that is where I was about 30 years ago. but no, it, I feel like it is very reflective of the crap, I lost the thread. Sorry, I looked up.
Reflective of your life or like.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Of where I am, like mentally and emotionally. You know, when we made Hal, it was during a kind of darker period in my life and in our old guitarist Billy's life, and then when we recorded it, we were up in Montreal for 2 weeks in the middle of winter, and you know, it was this like really weird thing where we were sequestered from each other and we made an album about loneliness, and so it was almost like method acting.
Oh man,
like method recording.
Well, how much does it play in that you have a theater background, that you're an actor, that you, how much does that play into the music that you put together?
I think that I mean, it definitely does come through in our live show and the things that we do, you know, in bits that we have and things that we build into the show. But I think that as far as the musical creation, it affects my songwriting, my storytelling, because I've always, it kind of, in my songs, I kind of tell linear stories, and I think it's because of that, like, everything has a cause, everything has subtext, and everything has to build to the
beginning,
next
middle,
thing.
End, right?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, and it's, I kind of envy songwriters who can write beautiful songs that aren't necessarily tethered to this rigid through line. And that's kind of one of the ways that just constantly being aware of narrative has kind of affected the music, my songwriting.
J.C. Brooks is in studio, the J.C. Brooks Band. The album is The Neon Jungle. Here's what we're going to do. The next gig in Chicago is on June 2nd. Joe's on Weed Street. We'll take a break. We'll get a little sound check here, and we'll hear some music. The J.C. Brooks Band, Studio 435. Stay with us. It's Studio 435. Live here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. The band is in position. I think what we're going to do, just because there's a lot going on, the J.C. Brooks Band in studio. We'll do the talking now, and we'll put all the music in the second half. What do you think of that, J.C.?
That sounds great.
J.C. Brooks in studio. The new album, The Neon Jungle, which can be found on all streaming sites. They got a tour that's starting up here. The next time you guys are in Chicago will be Joe's on Weed Street on June 2nd. Let me name the guys in the band here. J.C. Brooks, of course, Alec Lerman on guitar, Theodore Barry IV. That's nice. That's nice on bass. Jeremy Tromberg on keys, Kevin Marks on the drums, and Jovia Armstrong on percussion. You mentioned you're also doing a Pledge Now campaign. What are you doing?
We've teamed up with Pledge Music to kind of raise some money to help us, you know, get out there and tour some and promote this new album. And we got all kinds of stuff that we're going to do, private house concerts, all kinds of things. So auction off dates with us.
Is that the way, I mean, as you move forward in music and you don't necessarily have a record label that's paying the ways and things like that, I mean, is the idea of going direct to your fan base to say, hey, we'll come do this if we can get the money to do that. Is that the way of the future for music?
Probably. It seems like it's the way of the future for any sort of like innovative thing. But like on Pledge right now, there's like Ani DeFranco, Melissa Etheridge, right, like Keith Richards. Yeah. They're all like running Pledge campaigns where I'm like, Keith Richards, really? I know what kind of money you got. Nah.
No, but I feel like every time we even have a touring artist on, we'll talk to Matthew Sweet, and he's like, yeah, I'm doing this Kickstarter for my new album. I mean, it just seems like this is the new future way.
It used to seem so shameful, yeah, though, where I'm like, yes, please, hat in hand, give me money.
The guys who did Super Troopers, the Broken Lizard, they Kickstarted their entire Super Troopers 2, which is coming out.
Oh,
so
what?
The idea of going straight to an audience and just bypassing the middleman is not, I mean, you're right. At one point, it might have had a sort of shameful stink on it, but I don't think it does anymore. I think that's the way the business works.
Yeah, yeah, actually, because, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just to get you out in front of that person. You know, I don't think that there are that many, like, Streisands who are just like, I'm a studio artist only. Yeah, like, I mean, if you can be a studio artist only, God bless you, but, you know, yeah.
Do you, as a musician, and you're so well known as a stage musician, I mean, the band Uptown Sound, but also the J.C. Brooks Band, you guys, when you get on stage, it's electric. Do you have to, I mean, talk about that relationship with being, you know, recording in a studio and being a great live band? Do you have to sort of play that out? What's that relationship like?
I mean, it is what it is. I kind of hate being in the studio. There's a lot of pressure because, you know, even though nowadays I should be over it because everything lives forever because the internet. But, you know, it's one of those things where you're like making a permanent record and you want everything to be perfect. And, you know, it's really stressful for me personally. I know other people enjoy the studio more, and it's not that I hate it, but
you like
I
the feel of the moment, right?
I mean, who hasn't made a milkshake out of Tums? You know, so good.
So good.
So chalky.
The J.C. Brooks Band in Studio 435 tonight. J.C. Brooks, Alec Lehrman, Theodore Barry IV, Jeremy Tromberg, Kevin Marks, and Jovia Armstrong. We'll take a break and get an update from Rob Martier on the Tonight's News. And we come back, we'll supersize the second half of this thing and just get a couple tracks in a row here with the J.C. Brooks Band. Sound good?
Yeah.
All right. Stay with us. All right, back here in Studio 435 and 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Exciting. In studio tonight, the J.C. Brooks Band, J.C. Brooks. The album's called The Neon Jungle. It can be found on all the streaming sites. J.C. Brooks Band about to head out on tour. The next time they play here in Chicago, it's going to be June 2nd at Joe's on Weed Street. They are ready to go. We're gonna try one of these songs. We've been jamming out. There's an audience here on Michigan Avenue. They're ready for you guys. This song's called Drive. Is that right? All right, here it is. Drive to J.C. Brooks Band. Take it away, guys.
It's 2:23 in the jungle. Sunrise is miles away. Street light is burning out my window. I feel the current in the city below, an electric thrill. I just can't sit still on the other side of the door. Everything that I'm looking for, you call me. I'm always down. I'm there when the man comes around. Grab some cash. You can't confuse us with sense. We live fast. We never learn to strain. I'm driving on through the night to the other side. We live like we will never die. Can't be satisfied. I'm driving. We live like we will never die. Ooh. Can't be satisfied. They say you gotta go faster. It's the only cure. Keep that pedal bent right down to the floor. Got no time to delay. I sold my soul to the future yesterday. Now I'm driving on through the night to the other side. We live like we will never die. No, no, can't be satisfied. I'm driving on through the night. Yeah, yeah. We live like we will never die. Ooh. Can't be satisfied. Not tonight. We got nothing to lose. You and I got no control when we cruise. Satisfied. Ho, ho, I'm driving on through.
through the night, yeah, yeah, to the other side, yeah. We live like we will never die. No, no, get it, y'all. Can't be satisfied, no. That's why I'm driving home through the night. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That's okay. Amazing. The J.C. Brooks Band. Let's get some rock. Hey, what do you guys think out there? The crowd out on Michigan Avenue.
All right, man.
All right, there you go. The J.C. Brooks Band. The album is The Neon Jungle, which is can be found on all streaming sites. It's about to hit up on tour on the next gig in Chicago. Joe's on Weed Street on June 2nd. That's J.C. Brooks, Alec Lehrman on guitar, Theodore Barry IV on bass, Jeremy Tromberg on keys, Kevin Marks on drums, and Jovia Armstrong on percussions. Why don't we do this? We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll sound check. We'll hear two more. The J.C. Brooks Band here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Studio 435, our regular weekly showcase, bringing you some of the best live music Chicago has to offer tonight. One of Chicago's favorites, J.C. Brooks, the J.C. Brooks Band. They have a new album out, The Neon Jungle, which can be found on all streaming sites, of course. And they're about to head out on tour. They'll be back in Chicago on June 2nd. They'll be at Joe's on Weed Street. J.C. Brooks, Alec Lehrman on guitar, Theodore Barry IV on bass, Jeremy Tromberg on keys, Kevin Marks on drum, and Jovia Armstrong on percussion. All right, we're going to hear some more music. You guys ready to go? Let's do another track here. This one called Watch Me. Take it away, guys.
I can't be trusted with these eyes of lust. Trust me, I can't be forced to play nice. It ain't my style. Trust me, don't sleep, slip, trip. I'll be there to watch you fall. Trust me, it won't be pretty, pretty sick, right, y'all. Pretty sick. Watch me, watch me, watch me. I'm a madman. Watch me, watch me, watch me. I'm a bad man. Watch me, watch me. At the end of the day, I'm sad. Resist, I'll persist, I'll make your life a living hell. Don't stop, block, park your heart in these hands. No, no, it won't be pretty, pretty sick. Why, yo, dude, that's so sick. Watch me, watch me. I'm a madman. Watch me, watch me. They tell me I'm a bad, bad man, yeah. Watch me, watch me. At the end of the day, I get so sad. Sad about you, baby. Y'all know we're all losing this game of love, right? It's because we're constantly seeking out something brand new, what's slightly used to do, and it's probably better for you, you know? So I said, please, baby, baby, please, baby, baby, keep me around. You won't even know that I'm here tonight till I want some. Yeah. Yeah. Watch me dance, y'all.
about you, baby.
Oh, no.
I'm mad, I'm bad, I'm sad about you, baby.
That is why we do Studio 435 right there. The J.C. Brooks Band in studio tonight. Wow, that was great. Watch Me the Track, the album, which is out on all streaming right now. The Neon Jungle J.C. Brooks Band heading on tour. They're going to be in Chicago on June 2nd. Joe's on Weed Street. All right, we'll take a break here, our last one tonight, and we will have one more track from the amazing J.C. Brooks Band in Studio 435 tonight. Stay with us. Studio 435 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is our weekly segment, of course, where we bring you some of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight, one of Chicago's favorites. They've already jammed this. I mean, this studio, we are testing the limits of what the Showcase Studio can do, the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. All right. The JC. You're in great hands. You are. I'm telling you, man. This is good. This there's a feel to this. I like it. The album Neon Jungle. The Neon Jungle can be found on all the streaming sites, of course. J.C. Brooks Band about to head out on tour. The next gig is going to be at Joe's on Weed Street on June 2nd. All right. Let's hear one more song tonight. This song is called Jungle. J.C. Brooks, the J.C. Brooks Band. Take it away, guys.
Starts. The light screams while the heart talks, and you can feel it coming on me. It's impossible to bear, 'cause it's a fight that you know you won't win. When the shine of the smile blinds you to the reason why, he'll die when it flashes that grin, and you can't find a place to hide. Nothing dark enough in the night, and the breeze caressing your neck might be his breath. I don't mind if my heart is on the divide in the jungle. Sometimes you gotta leave your heart behind to survive. Tomorrow's never kind. So
face your death in the mirror, honey. Sometimes you gotta leave it all behind to beat the jungle.
Wow, Studio 435, jamming a night. The J.C. Brooks Band in studio. J.C. Brooks, Alec Lerman, Theodore Barry IV, Jeremy Tromberg, Kevin Marks, and Jovia Armstrong. A tremendous, tremendous performance. That was the song The Jungle. The band, of course, the album that's out right now, The Neon Jungle, can be found at all streaming sites, and they will be playing at Joe's on Weed Street on June 2nd. It's great to see you, as always. As we wrap up here, the music, it's so, I love it. I love it. It's one of the best bands we've ever had in Studio 435. You guys put it together. Bob Ferguson, big hand from Bob.
Yeah.
To be able to pull this off with all the different things that are happening in studio. It's tremendous. So what's next for you guys? I mean, this tour is a big deal. I mean, I was looking at all the dates. I'm like, here we go. This is going to be living the life of the rock star for the summer.
Yeah, and it's only the beginning, man. I'm super excited because there's some places that we haven't been in a while. Like, as we've been recording, we've been kind of laying low and just doing, like, New York, Philly, D.C., and then, like, when we go out to the West Coast, just hitting the big places. So it's going to be nice to actually be driving out and driving our way back and hitting all these places where we haven't been in forever. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
When you talk about summer gigs, are a handful of these going to be outside? I mean, is that the...
I mean, I hope, I think. But then again, that might be terrible because I wear all black and synthetic fabrics because I'm not a smart man. I'm not a smart guy, or maybe I'm just a really good masochist. I don't know. One or the other.
Well, you get it going up there. I remember seeing you at certain. I mean, I've seen you out. So you play outside festivals a lot in the summertime.
Oh yeah,
you guys have for years. But I mean, the band, as you get ready for this to tour this music. I mean, what are you most excited about when you think about touring this record and bringing it to the places that haven't seen you guys in a while?
Just really getting back out there again. Like, I love living on the as much as I miss my man, hey Rick, and my dog. I love being on the road. I love playing for people and meeting people after the show and giving sweaty ass hugs. And, it's just a thing. It's wonderful and fun. And, I completely lost my train of thought.
That's okay, man.
But no, that's what we're looking forward to. And not to hammer on something, but bring it back around. In order to do that, we got to raise some money. And we just launched a Pledge Music campaign, and you can find it on our Facebook page or references to it on the Twitters and the Instagrams and whatnot. And you can help us out, and we got all kinds of stuff that we can give to you, like free concerts and... Oh, God, you can't say that on the radio. But other stuff, fun stuff, stuff that nobody else can get.
That's great. The
Hand concerts and mouth concerts.
Oh, there you go. The J.C. Brooks Band, J.C. Brooks, Alec Lerman, Theodore Barry IV, Jeremy Tromberg, Kevin Marks, and Jovia Armstrong. The album is called The Neon Jungle. We just heard some of the music from it, and they'll be touring. They're going to be in Chicago. Joe's on Weed Street on June 2nd. J.C. Brooks, the band, thank you guys for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having us, Justin.